This morning, in this hour of the show, we will be talking about what it is that we can do to meet one of the most basic human needs, and that is the need for clean water. It's been estimated that something like 1.2 billion people around the world live without access to safe drinking water, and something like twice that don't have access to adequate sanitation. And of course, that has very important links to either disease or to wellness, depending on how it is you want to frame that. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about the efforts that are being made both by governments and non-governmental organizations to make clean water more available. And our guest for the program is Ambassador John McDonald. He is a lawyer, a diplomat, former international civil servant. He spent 20 years of his career in Western Europe and the Middle East. He worked for 16 years on United Nations Economic and Social Affairs. And currently, he is the chairman, the co-founder of the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy, which is based in Washington and focuses on national and international ethnic conflicts. He's here visiting the campus to talk about water and water issues. And he is one of the individuals who have come here to take part in a conference going on over several days called Troubled Waters in a Globalizing World, looking at various kinds of water issues. And it is jointly sponsored by the various centers on the campus that concentrate on particular parts of the world: Asian studies, Latin American studies, Caribbean studies, African studies, and so forth. And he's been good enough to come and spend a little time with us here this morning and talk. And of course, as we talk, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. The number to call, 333-9455. That's the number to use if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. And in addition to those elements of his biography that I listed briefly, because to go on at length would take far too much time, I do want to mention that Ambassador McDonald is a graduate of the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, has his bachelor's degree and his law degree here from the U of I. Well, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, David.
To begin, I think that we should talk about the scope of the need or the problem, depending on how it is that you define that. And indeed, that this figure, I know that I came up with it from a publication from your institute. That's a staggering number. It's big enough when you talk about over a billion people not having access to clean water. But when you ask about sanitation, then you double that figure. We're talking about an awful lot of people.
Well, that's certainly true, but through the United Nations, the world has made dramatic progress over the last 20 years in this whole field. Actually, the UN got started in 1977 at a first ever world conference on just water itself, which is a very broad based issue, of course. One of the recommendations that came out of that world conference, one of the paragraphs out of the 100 recommendations, was to launch or create a 10-year period just focusing on drinking water and sanitation, one piece of the broader global issue, but an important piece, as you've just indicated. I was at the State Department at that time, and I knew that working on United Nations affairs at the UN is pretty slow sometimes, and so what I was able to do was to pluck out that one paragraph way back in 1978, to see if we couldn't launch that decade, which had been agreed upon by the world but had to be acted upon. And so I spent the next year and a half with working through various UN agencies to finally get that issue on the global agenda at the United Nations General Assembly in the fall of 1980. I drafted a resolution which would launch the decade, and actually was able to achieve that by having the world body adopt this idea by consensus and launch the first UN water decade on January the 1st, 1981, which went on for 10 years. And the fascinating figure at the end of that 10 years, which the World Health Organization came up with, was that as a result of effort on the part of hundreds of thousands of people around the world, but with a focus on that issue, that 1.1 billion people in the world in that 10-year period got access to safe water for the first time in their lives, and 769 million people got access to sanitary facilities for the first time in their lives. Well, when you think back upon that, those are staggering figures of success. And the United Nations was able to take that issue and really make something of it on a global scale, which was very exciting. But then in 1990, at the end of the decade, it dropped off the agenda of governments. Nobody was pushing. And so they sort of forgot about it. Now, various non-governmental organizations came into being, but it wasn't the same as having governments do it. So as a private citizen now, as head of my little non-governmental organization, 2 years ago, I started pressing for a second decade to build on the success of the first decade. There were two world conferences, one in New York, the Millennium Conference, and one in Johannesburg in 2002, which had specific recommendations for drinking water and sanitation to reduce by half that figure that you just said by the year 2015. But having worked on United Nations Affairs for many years and knowing that that was not enough, I thought maybe we could launch, as a private citizen, I could launch a second decade. And that was a very ambitious idea. Again, I wrote a resolution to make this happen. And then I went to various agencies in the United States government, because you need a government to take a leadership role at the UN to put a resolution through. And they said, well, this is an interesting idea, but we're really not that enthusiastic. So they turned it down as an idea. So then I went to the Dutch, and I went to the British, and the French, and the Germans, the Norwegians, the Swedes, Canadians, Japanese, all donor governments. And they all said, well, that's an interesting idea, but no leadership. So time was running out, and so on the 1st of August of last year, I thought out of the box, and I said, I'm going to go to Tajikistan. Now, my guess is that 99.9% of the people in this country don't know where Tajikistan is or anything about it, but it is in Central Asia, part of the former Soviet Empire. And they had gotten their act together at the United Nations a couple of years before, and they had pushed through a very fine resolution creating the year 2003, last year, as the International Year of Freshwater. And that put them on the world map. So I went to the ambassador in New York, and I said, you're doing a great job for this year. How would you like to be on the world scene for the next 10 years? Let's take your idea and make it into a second UN water decade on drinking water sanitation. Well, he saw immediately the benefit to his country and to the world, and to implement those resolutions with a goal of 2015. So he said, great. But then he said, you'll have to convince my president. Well, I did not know the president of Tajikistan. And I said, well, I need your help. So I wrote a letter in my resolution, and then he forwarded with his approval to the president of Tajikistan. Well, luck was on our side, because 3 weeks later, the president opened a regional conference on water issues in his capital, in Dushanbe, Tajikistan. And in his opening speech, he proposed a second decade. And the conferees thought it was a great idea and approved it, the concept, but they were not United Nations, of course. But then he told his ambassador to get to work. In the UN system, you normally have to go through, as I had earlier, a whole series of meetings and conferences, but this one had to be parachuted in at the top because the time was so short, because we wanted to move the year into a decade at the end of the year, because the momentum was there and he had to continue it. So I said, what you should do is put this on the general committee agenda and have your chief of state make a speech at the United Nations launching the idea, and then a head of state has priority and these things will actually work. So he did that, and it worked. And so I said, you have to get 120 signatures on your draft resolution before the West will come along. If you can get the developing world on board, then these countries that I went to and didn't succeed, and by the way, don't go near them until you have those 120 signatures. And so we worked together, and I was able, through friends and connections, to get all of the Latin American votes to sign up. And so by the early mid-November, he had 120 signatures. And sure enough, the Canadians were the first to sign on as a developed nation, and then the Japanese, and then the European Union broke ranks. And so by on December the 23rd of last year, 192 nations of the General Assembly unanimously adopted the second resolution, launching the second UN Water Decade. So we're really, it's going to start on March 22nd, which is World Water Day next year. And I do believe that those figures that you mentioned will not only be achieved, but I think that they will be go beyond that.
Well, you talked earlier about the just how much was accomplished in the, this first
right.
water decade. How much was spent? What did it cost to do that?
Far less than the World Bank and others expected. And that's a very good question. Historically, the bank and others project by the tens of billions of dollars what something like this would actually take. What happened was that we began to think outside of the box again and actually implementation. My focus has always been on community development, getting particularly the rural poor to buy into these concepts, and then to get the political leadership of the country to realize that this is politically to their advantage, because if they can go to their people and say, we're providing safe water for you, they'll get the votes or they'll get elected or reappointed or whatever. And a lot of political leaders recognize that. But then you had the practical problem, because the West historically has gone into third world countries and has said, we know what's best for you, and we're going to put a pump right here without even consulting the village elders about it. And then they do that. And then in 6 months, the pump breaks down, and the villagers look around for money for spare parts, and they can only buy spare parts for foreign exchange, for dollars. Well, they didn't have any dollars. So the well remains non-working. And there are thousands of wells around the world which don't work because of lack of foreign exchange. So the new idea was to develop local industry to produce simple pumps cheaply with inexpensive production with local steel, local parts, and so forth. And this happened in a great way. In India, for example, over that 10-year period, 1.5 million simple pumps were developed with local steel, local industry, and sold for rupees, so that when the pump broke down, the villagers could buy the spare parts in local currency, in this case in rupees. And in that first decade, 360 million Indians got access to safe water because of that simple pump, locally made. So this is what I'm talking about. You can be innovative. You don't get stuck on the amount of dollars. What you do is get people involved and concerned, and they'll make a difference.
Yeah. When you look at where it is that the money came from for the first decade of water, or where you think that it's going to come from the next, what proportion would come, do you expect, from governments or bodies like the World Bank, and how much might come from non-governmental organizations that I would expect would substantially be privately supported?
I don't think anybody's put a dollar sign on the second decade, but I do believe that private sector will become much more involved in this upcoming decade than they were in the first decade. You're right that the government and the bank and others did put in money, a lot of money, in the first decade. But also, it was basically within nation states. They put in the most money, and local communities put in money. A lot of it in terms of labor to help to do these things that we're talking about. The other thing that we were able to do in the first decade, which I hope will continue in the second decade, is to involve women in the whole process. As you know, the women are the water carriers of the world. You see picturesque postcards with a woman carrying a pot on her head of water. Well, that's a pretty picture, but it's a very hard work. And young kids get involved as well at a very tender age, because the men expect the water to be there when they need it, and they don't care how it gets there. And it's the women who carry the water. So by involving women, first of all, in the decision-making process, where to put the pump, and then getting them involved in maintaining the pump, teaching them how to repair the pump. So that is their task. They are the women in these villages with new pumps are responsible for those pumps and for the water that comes out of them. And so they are very proud of their role, and they play a major role. And then in their spare time, they were formerly carrying water, people and agencies and others have helped them with new skills, how to read, how to write, how to take care of chickens, how to build, put in a small farm, so that their time is spent constructively. And then, if there's interest, and usually there is, you teach women how to use soap and how to prevent diarrhea from reappearing every day. By using soap and having clean water, you can reduce health issues dramatically at the village level. So it's a multifaceted project we're talking about, which is really very sophisticated when you consider all the things that can be done with the proper will. So involving the community is critical, and it's hard to put a dollar sign on that.
Mm-hmm. When you think back to, you told the story of trying to go to people at the United Nations and people who are representing large countries that were in a position to make significant contributions to dealing with the problem. You said to them, well, you know, we had this decade before of water. It was very successful. Let's do that again. And you said their reaction was, well, you know, this doesn't excite us very much. And I guess I wonder whether you think that was because either they felt that there were other things that were more important that were preoccupying them, or that something as simple and low-tech as providing clean water just doesn't grab people's attention. And unfortunately, I think in international development, often that's been the story. The most basic, the simplest things, people seem to want to bypass that for things that are actually far more complicated and perhaps far more expensive.
No, actually, I think you're right on both counts. I think there was negativism on both of those issues, and which is a very good point. I created my own non-governmental organization in 1982 called Global Water, and it's globalwater.org is our webpage. And I'm still chairman of the board. It's a small-scale operation, but we try to help people in rural areas in various parts of the world. We have the funds for it. I lobbied for several years in the U.S. Congress to try to get them interested in the mid-80s in water as an issue. I could not get anybody to get interested, not even hold a hearing. Now, they were interested in bread, and bread for the world became a very popular thing, but they couldn't get around to water, and I keep telling them, you know, you can live longer with water than you can with no bread. Mm-hmm. I couldn't make that shift. And now, just now, actually, I'm in touch with several congressmen who have made speeches on the floor of the House on these various issues. And I do believe that the time is changing. I believe that the U.S. Congress is going to get even more involved in the next few years than they have been in the past, because this is, as you say, a fundamental issue that has to be focused on by the number one superpower in the world. We have to acknowledge the need and see if we can be helpful.
Perhaps I should introduce again our guest for this hour as we're getting close to our midpoint, Ambassador John McDonald. He is a lawyer, a diplomat, former international civil servant. He spent 20 years in Western Europe and the Middle East, worked for 16 years on United Nations Economic and Social Affairs, and currently he is the chairman and co-founder of the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy in Washington, where they focus on national and international ethnic conflicts. And this particular issue, that is water and access to clean water, as you have heard, is something that he's been interested in and working on for quite a while. He's here on the campus to take part in a conference over several days looking at global water issues. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Perhaps I might ask, again, maybe the answer here is obvious, but why it is that of the many things that you might have chosen yourself to focus on in your efforts, both in government and non-government organizations, why water was the thing that you chose?
I guess it's because I'm people-oriented, and I believe that you have to start with development there. And here was an opportunity with this 1977 resolution which was being ignored. I thought, well, why not see if we can't make a difference? And it seems to have worked. Interesting note on a conference that I'm attending right now. It's called Troubled Waters. In my comments earlier today at the meeting, I suggested at the end that they should change the word troubled waters to peaceful waters, because I believe that that conflict is happening now, but we want to ensure that violent conflict does not ensue. And so I would like to make those peaceful. We're actually co-sponsoring a meeting at Columbia University next April on water and peace, which I think is something that one has to consider. I believe that the people who are working in water issues today across the board are always working in the conflict area. Someone is always disagreeing with them. The key is to keep it nonviolent, and I believe that this can be done in the field of water and sanitation because the professional base around the world of skilled people is enormous. Every country has to face this problem, and they are doing it basically quite well. But they are also, whether they realize it or not, are informal negotiators dealing with conflict on a daily basis. And so I'm optimistic that wars will not break out over scarcity of water issues because the people who are managing the water will be able to negotiate at a professional level to ensure this does not happen.
Well, there you point to an issue that has been raised. Certainly we know that wars have always been fought over control of natural resources, but there are some people who have said they think in the future that conflict over water, access to water and control of water, that will be significant. You seem to be saying that your take on it is a little bit different in the sense that you think that there are enough people who understand how important it is who are willing to work together so that you don't think that that's going to happen.
Well, I say there will be conflicts, but I say there will not be violent conflicts. There will be disagreements where dialogue and interaction, negotiation, mediation will take place and must take place, but that it can be done peacefully, and that's my goal. For example, a few years ago, Turkey decided to build a dam on the Tigris-Euphrates River, which went through Syria. And the Syrians got very upset about this, and they almost went to war over that issue. But professionals, both engineers and diplomats, got together and were able to negotiate an agreement. This is what I'm saying, that there certainly is great potential for conflict, and there will be conflicts, but I don't think they'll be violent. You can look at the Nile River Basin, which is four or five countries have negotiated many years over disagreements on this, but they've never gone to war. The same as with the Nile and the Danube and the Mekong and in the Far East and over the Indus waters in India and Japan. They've always been able to bring about a peaceful solution. So I, as you can tell by this time, I'm an optimist, so I think that you have to look at that from an optimistic point of view.
You talked earlier in the earlier example about something as simple as having working pumps to supply wells in small villages, and that is a relatively low-tech kind of a thing.
That's correct.
Are you at all interested in industrial pollution of water sources and how that may well be an issue, particularly in the developing world?
Well, it certainly is an issue. We have not tackled that ourselves, but the whole problem of cleaning up lakes and rivers. I live in Washington, D.C., and the Chesapeake Bay is a major bone of contention because it crosses many states. And environmentalists and government people are always at odds with each other about what has to be done and how much money should be spent. But that's because pesticides and industrial waste flow into the Chesapeake and are not controlled at the source sufficiently in the eyes of the environmentalists. So there's a constant give and take. There's constant tension, but there's never been actually overt conflict. And so that's where I draw the line. But you've raised a very important point because this is happening all over the world. And it's a constant struggle between those who want to keep the waters clean or cleaner than they are and those who are helping to pollute them.
We have, I think, someone who wanted to join the conversation here. Others are welcome. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Charleston, not too far away. Line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It's an interesting topic this morning. I guess I don't feel as optimistic as your guest about the United States being willing to cooperate with any international efforts to maintain clean water, clean air, and clean environment. And as someone who has long-time international experience, I wonder if you could speak to where you think our current administration is going to take these type of efforts. Because I agree, clean... I have a baby that's crying in the background, so I'll have to hang up. But
sure.
I just would like to hear your comments on where you think things are really going to go in the next 4 years. I mean, our administration has shown no willingness to cooperate with the United Nations and has withdrawn from, you know, the Kyoto Accord, and for example. So I'm going to hang up, and I'd like you to speak to those issues, please. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Well, as you heard me say earlier, I am an optimist. On the Kyoto Accords, for example, just the other day, the Russians signed the accords, and they are now going into effect. And for some years, nobody thought that would happen. So change can come about. I have actually met with two assistant secretaries of state about the idea of a second water decade starting next March. And both of them are enthusiastic supporters of the idea. Acknowledge that the present structure of the UN is not adequate, and so we're trying to work out a way to strengthen that structure so that it will become more effective. But as far as I'm concerned, there has been important interest on the part of some key figures in the present administration in making the second UN Water Decade a major success.
We have someone else. This caller is in Gibson City on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this because in August, September, I spent the month on the West Bank with a peace group, and we also work with Israeli peace groups, and one of the things we did in the West Bank was we went out to the South Hebron Hills to help the farmers there get water because they could not get it for fear of being beaten up and chased away by settlers or even the Israeli Defense Force. So I guess it just really opened up my eyes to what's going on, and I guess I wonder if you have any suggestions, we as citizens of the United States, of, well, I guess I'm concerned with Israel because I know about it. I know there's other places, but, you know, how do we go about educating people in our government, in our world, that, you know, we need, everybody needs water, you know, that's a basic need. I just wonder if you have any ideas of, you know, how we go about doing this. Thank you very much, and I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thank you for the question. I am familiar with the issue that you just raised in Israel and Palestine. Actually, you remember the Oslo Accords of a few years ago, which were operating for 3 years. And there were a series of committees and subcommittees coming out of Oslo, which were working at the time. To this, at the moment, the only committee that's really working is the one on water, because all parties realize the very importance of water, as you just stated. And so they are cooperating today on a daily basis with regard to water issues. And our U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is one of the people on that committee that they're trying to help in that particular regard. The broader issue, we're trying, as you may have heard my earlier presentation, the United Nations has now agreed to a second world decade on water and sanitation, which will go into effect in March of next year. And I believe the main focus for that is the very issue you're talking about, getting people involved at the grassroots level. This is going to be a major effort, and I do believe it will be a successful one by the year 2015.
Once again, questions are welcome. Well, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Ambassador John McDonald, he is the founder, currently chairman, co-founder of the Institute for Multitrack Diplomacy in Washington, D.C. I wonder if I might give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about the idea of multi-track diplomacy. There's something that I know you have written on, and what is it exactly?
Well, in 1985, I wrote the first book on what we call Track 2 diplomacy. Track 1 is government-to-government, which is instructed and formal and not very risk-taking in interaction between nation-states. Track 2 is only non-government. It's non-governmental organizations, everything outside of government. It's more risk-taking. It's more open. It's not instructed. And its design is to help Track 1 in particularly difficult conflict situations. My colleague, Dr. Louise Diamond, and I then wrote a book in 1991 called Multi-Track Diplomacy. We expanded this two-track idea to nine tracks. Track 3 is the business community. Track 4 is cultural exchanges like the Fulbright program. Track 5 is what we do, education and training. Track 6 is peace activism. Track 7 is religion. Track 8 is money, trying to raise funds because we don't charge for our services overseas. And then there's an inner circle called Track 9, which is communication, which I believe is the heart of what we do, because we take what we call a systems approach to peace. We say that no one track, including Track 1 or government, has all the answers, and they cannot build a peace process by themselves. The only way to build a peace process that will work is to bring all of these communities together, have them work together to bring about change. So that's basically what we're about.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a very, very interesting idea, and something that I think people perhaps don't often understand is how the contribution that can be made, particularly by non-governmental organizations and any opportunity that people have for some people, person-to-person contact, that you can do things with those kinds of contacts that governments simply cannot do. And I think that we don't often enough acknowledge just how important non-governmental organizations and contacts are out in the world, and how much work, how much good work, conflict prevention, peace work, development work, so forth, are done by organizations like that.
Well, I found a long time ago that the only way to solve a conflict, and this is at any level of society, with your kids or your family or all the way up to globally, is to sit down face-to-face and talk about it. If you can't do that first step, you're not going to get anywhere. We started working in divided Cyprus, so the Muslims in the north, the Christians in the south, back in 1992. It took us 15 months working separately with the Muslims in the north and the Christians in the south to bring six people together from each side face-to-face just to talk about their problems. And they bonded within an hour because they trusted us, which is critical, and they had the skills to understand the problems. And we made them our steering committee, and they've been working with us for many years. So it's that face-to-face interaction that is critical to success in this regard. My most recent example of this just took place last month, and it took place in Kathmandu, Nepal. It only took 4 years to put this together and to build trust. But we brought 10 people from Kashmir, a divided province, 10 people from Pakistan, Kashmir, together with 10 people from Indian Kashmir, the first meeting in 57 years, till when they were divided. And it was incredible. Neither side thought the other side would show up. They were so suspicious of the other. We were fortunate to have 8 women out of the 20 people, and for me, the women are the peace builders. There was a lot of tension and animosity, stereotyping, when they first met. But we were in a nice lodge about an hour outside of Kathmandu, and they couldn't go anywhere, so they had to work and eat meals together. At the end of that first evening after dinner, just one little story to tell you. One of the men from Pakistan, Kashmir, was very angry with his counterparts, and because his sister was living in a town of Jammu, which is in Indian Pakistan. He hadn't been able to connect with her or contact her with her for decades. One of the women in the Indian group lived in Jammu. And so she said, oh, tell me about where your sister lives. And he gave her the address. She said, well, I live only 10 minutes from there. Let me take a letter from you and some pictures of us together, and I'll give them to your sister when I get back. Well, that kind of dramatic interpersonal breakthrough happened every day. And that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to break down barriers by people interacting with each other. That's what our goal is.
Mm-hmm. Something else that I think is very striking is it seems that some of the places where non-governmental organizations are most needed and most useful are also some of the most dangerous places there are. And I think that we have seen examples of, in fact, people who were from non-governmental organizations working in places where they were trying to do relief and development work to assist people there, deliberately targeted by combatants in those places. We've certainly seen it in Iraq, and I'm sure that it has happened other places. And the sad ultimate result is that then the leaders of these organizations decided simply too dangerous to have their people there, and that they pull them out.
Right. Well, I tell you, we have a fundamental concept with regard to that issue. We only go where we are invited by the people in the conflict, not by governments.
Mm-hmm.
We're not imposed by governments on situations. But when we are invited by people, it means that they have now decided that they would like to come together and learn some new skills and make a first step in a peace-building process. So we don't go to Burma, for example, because we don't get invited there by the people in the conflict, because they know that they invite us, we might be targeted, and they might be targeted. So that's our basic premise. When we're invited by people, and we'll go wherever we are invited. We've been in Liberia in the middle of the civil war there in the mid-90s because people asked us to come, and they protected us.
Mm-hmm. Is it useful then to perhaps this is the essence of diplomacy, to have someone involved in a conflict, in trying to mediate a conflict, who has no stake in the ultimate outcome, or at least is perceived? I suppose your job as a diplomat is to be seen as not having any stake in the outcome, and therefore not having any sort of bias to one side or the other.
Correct. No, we try to be neutral in every sense of the word. There's something else you should realize is that we don't negotiate agreements, because that's what governments are supposed to do. What we do is work with key people, community leaders, provide them with skills, with new ideas, new approaches, and then they, in their own language, in their own time frame, can bring these ideas to the attention of the Track 1 negotiators. So we step back. We never cross the line between Track 2 and Track 1. If we did, we'd be kicked out of the country by Track 1. So it's a very interesting process, and it's a slow process. You have to be patient. It takes time, energy, and a little money, of course.
Hmm. Well, can you point to other examples where contacts made on Track 2 have pushed governments to then work on Track 1 where they otherwise would not have, a sort of a bottom-up kind of diplomacy?
Right. Yes, I believe we can. We have several examples. I could say that about Cyprus, where we worked for some 8 years. We've done that in Liberia. In the present government, 4 of the private citizens that we worked with in the mid-90s are now members of the cabinet, and we are still in touch with each other. So they can bring these skills that they've learned in the past into the future, sometimes over a long period of time, but they don't forget them, and they become more effective as a result of that.
We have about 10 minutes left, and perhaps I should introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in. Ambassador John McDonald is a lawyer, a diplomat, a former international civil servant. He spent 20 years of his career working in Western Europe and the Middle East, also worked for 16 years on United Nations Economic and Social Affairs, and currently is the chairman, the co-founder of the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy in Washington, D.C., which, among other things, is interested in national and international ethnic conflicts and working on those sorts of things. He's here visiting the campus to take part in a symposium looking at global water issues. It's titled Troubled Waters in a Globalizing World that's now going on. At the beginning of the program, we started to talk about water, which is one of the issues that he is particularly interested in and has been working on for some time. We do have some callers here to bring into the conversation. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering about the third track, how that impinges on the first track, business, how that impinges on government-to-government interaction. I understand that, I think I understand that the top three conglomerates that are involved in water are French, Vivendi, Suez, and I think it's Bouygues, Saur, or something like that, and that they control 70% of the existing world water market, and I'm just curious: is that affecting our relations with France, to your knowledge? And then, number two, I was wondering about the NAFTA, and if that is going to make Canada sell its water to us, whether they like it or not.
Well, can you respond to?
Well, this is several questions, actually. I would like to say that the track three, which is the role of business and conflict, is a very important arena because up until quite recently, major businesses have not realized the relationship between their involvement and the whole concept of peace building. My discussion with them is that, for example, in Kashmir, let me give you an example, in Indian Pakistan, in 1988 there were 800,000 tourists going to Kashmir. A few months later it was zero, and it continued to be zero for many years. You can imagine the impact on the economics of that community. We were able to bring business leaders together within India and then within Pakistan to focus on the role that they could play behind the scenes informally in helping governments to search for solutions. In the subcontinent, the three power bases, there's government, there's military, and there's business. And historically, business didn't really interact with the other two. But now they are, and they're beginning to realize that if they could reduce fear in Kashmir, for example, so the tourists would go back there, they could have a major impact on their own business for investment or reinvestment. So they have a role to play, but they're not that focused on this yet because it's a learning curve for them. With regard to the major bottled water producers, I think you have a very good point, and that's one of the issues that's being discussed at this very conference. They have a key role to play, or they are playing it, in a multi-billion-dollar business. But in my own philosophy, I believe that water is a human right, and that the water should be accessible to everyone. This bottled water issue, I think, has grown dramatically in the last decade because of a general fear that the tap water is not good in many parts of the world. So what we're trying to do on a global scale through this second UN water decade is to get people to buy into the concept of safe water, which would come, so we say, from the skies and not from a bottle. So that's our goal at the moment.
Well, do you think, though, that there might in the future be increasing tension between people who are interested in water for commercial use And those people who are simply interested in the access to water. For example, yesterday we had a guest here from India who was here to take part in this conference, and she said, you know, one of the ironies in India is that increasingly big users of water happen to be the people who produce Pepsi and Coke. And she said, you know, there are villages where people don't have access to clean water, but they can go out and buy a Coke.
That's correct.
And that, you know, there may always be some tension between commercial interests and those people who say access to clean water is a basic human right, and that that's something that we need to preserve and work toward.
Well, I totally agree. And as an example of concern that our questioner raised, in the country of Bolivia recently, one of the major corporations in effect took over the provision of water for a whole city, and you can only get bottled water. And finally, the people rose up in anger and peacefully demonstrated and got the city to change the rules and the country to change the rules. So it's a very important issue, I believe, and one that we have to look at very carefully. It could get out of hand, is what I'm saying.
We're getting pretty short on time here. There's one more caller I'd like to try to get to. I hope the last caller will forgive me if I go on to Oakwood and a caller here on our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Wonderful program. I was just wondering, you said it was multi-track diplomacy. Is that what the term was?
That's correct. It's the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy. You might check our webpage. It's imtd.org. And we have some documentation there on the Second Water Decade that might be of interest, and we also talk about our ethnic conflict programs.
Okie dokie. Oh, I will check it out. Just kind of an off-the-wall question here. Given, I don't know, what seems to be a trend anymore, disturbing, kind of, towards, I don't know, maybe isolation on our part or unilateral action that we want to take around the world, how much of an impediment or concern is it to that multi-tracked business? I'm just a factory worker. We sit around at the break tables. Of course, any topic's open for discussion. And so many times you hear well, gosh darn, they've been fighting for thousands of years, let them fight, you know, that kind of attitude. And I'm just wondering, how do you combat the trend that seems to be going on today, and what steps, you know, you take to combat that in what you're doing?
Well, thank you. That's a very excellent question and a very serious one. You're absolutely right. I've heard that phrase many times. In today's world, there are 37 ethnic conflicts in the world, which more than 1,000 people will be killed this year. 37. They are all within national boundaries. They're all within nation states. And the whole concept of national sovereignty, which says that you can't go in and help a state without their permission, gets involved. So it's a very key issue. And this ethnic conflict has really exploded since the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And so we have to deal with this on a regular basis, and we do it through a willingness to go where we are invited to go to try to help people. We've worked over the last 12 years in some 15 countries, in Israel and Palestine, in Bosnia and Cyprus, and 7 or 8 countries in Africa, in Israel, India, Pakistan, Nepal, Kashmir, Sri Lanka, and in the Caucasus, in the country of Georgia. We have been invited into each of those conflicts to try to bring about not a resolution, but a starting a first step toward recognition that the enemy, whoever that enemy is also a human being and has the same hopes for the future that you have. And once you can establish that, then you can start communicating and build a peace process.
Does the recent trend and how it might be perceived around the world, has that become a greater impediment to what you're trying to do?
I would say yes, because what we're finding, realistically, is that it's harder to raise money today than it was before 9/11 to do these kinds of things. So it is difficult.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
I think the criticism has been made of the United States and its lack of involvement particularly when it comes to things like international development and how little we provide in terms of aid for that effort. And having said that, though, I think that criticism has been made about as long as I can remember. And I'm not sure, is it in fact any, if one thinks that that is a problem, is it any bigger problem now than it has ever been?
Well, let me put that into some perspective in money terms. I was involved in the post-war Europe and the Marshall Plan. I lived in Europe for 8 years and was in Paris for 2.5 years in the early days of the Marshall Plan. In 1952, the United States people provided 3.25% of our gross national product, 3.25% of our GNP, to rebuild Western Europe and Japan. Now, that's a staggering figure. We were at the top of the list for the world. Today, we're at the bottom of the list of the developed world. We are at 0.15%, 0.15% of our GNP to development assistance. To me, that's very sad because we were the world leader for many years. We're not today.
Well, there we must stop as we are at the end of the time. Our guest, Ambassador John McDonald, he is chairman, co-founder of the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy. And as he said, if you have internet access and if you're interested in finding out more about the Institute and what they're about, you can visit their website, www.imtd.org, and read about them. Thank you very much for being
here. My pleasure.